Merkle Media.
Hey you everybody, and welcome to Back It Up Fridays with Hammer Lane Legends. I am your host, Jack Merkle, and I'm here to deliver you the goods on a Friday. Fry-yay, baby, let's go. And you know what? We've got a good one for you, as always. Episode 9, Trucker Sees Bigfoot. If you like Bigfoot, if you don't like Bigfoot, this one has it all for you. The guys talked to Jim. This was a long time ago, but talking to Jim about his experience over in Iraq as a driver. That's where he got his first experience. Then coming back over here to the States and seeing something they believe is Bigfoot that could see him eye to eye in a freight liner. Crazy. But this is a great one. I hope you guys have had a great week so far getting into the weekend. Hope you enjoy your weekend. We have a wedding this weekend. This is my sister's wedding. Everybody, the whole family's up in town, and we're going to be celebrating for the weekend. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for sharing the show, liking the show, and whatnot. And if you guys haven't checked us out yet, check us out on Facebook, Instagram. We're all over the place. And keep sharing the show. We appreciate you guys. So have a great weekend and enjoy the show. Peace out.
He put it in park, threw open the driver's door, ran out the side of the car, across the front of it, and jumped right off the side of the bridge in front of me.
The only people that really pulled over were truckers.
He said, "We're going to Hodge," and he didn't slow down. He went across the median onto the oncoming traffic, but where they could see him coming, they just got out of the way.
I noticed his plane was really low. It went right in front of us, hit the fence, and it spun around. You know, 30 seconds more, he could have hit us.
And I went around that truck, and a guy stepped out from behind the truck and threw a piece of wood, and it shot through my window just like a spear and stuck in the back of the cab of my truck.
That's probably one of the stranger things I've seen.
Welcome to the show, everybody. You're listening to Hammer Lane Legends. Thank you very much for being here. And if you have a crazy, wild experience from the Hammer Lane, we want to hear about it on Hammer Lane Legends. All you got to do is shoot us an email at hammerlanelegends@gmail.com or go to the website, hammerlanelegends.com, hit the contact section, and you can reach us that way as well. Either way works for us, just get a hold of us. Now, today we got a great show planned for everybody. Me and my dad are joined by Jim, and Jim is going to be sharing his different experiences that he's had, including times that he was overseas in Iraq as part of the military, driving truck over there. But he also talks about driving truck over the road here stateside. He's got a couple different stories for us, including one time where a figure walked across the road, and it was pretty big, and it was eye level with him in his truck. So we wonder what that could be, but some of us think it might be Bigfoot. So let's get to it right now. Okay, today we got a great guest coming on the show. We got Jim. Jim, how you doing, man?
I'm doing pretty good. How are y'all doing?
Doing good.
We're doing real well.
So, Jim,
good to hear.
I'm hearing that you have some wild experiences from Iraq. See, I guess you heard Sam's interview that we had for episode 2, and that kind of spawned you to reach out to us, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, cool. So let me ask you, before we get into these stories as far as the military goes, is that where you got your driving experience to start in the military, or were you a driver here in the States and then you joined the military?
No, I joined up when I was 19. Really didn't have much experience before that. Just little odd jobs here and there. I drove in convoys in Iraq. I'm currently a driver now as well. So, but yeah, that was where I really cut my teeth on driving.
Well, I'd say that's a place to cut your teeth. Holy crap. I mean, I've met people that, you know, have gotten their CDL through the military in a sense where, you know, they then had a transfer over to a civilian license. And, you know, the vehicles you drive over there are just, you know, they're totally different than what we drive here. That's for sure.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah.
So, you joined the military, at 19 years old. Take it away for us, man. Share with us, you know, some of the experiences that you've had over there, because, I'm very interested to hear about it.
Okay. Yeah. I joined up when I was 19, back in 2005. I did all my basic training, my AIT or the technical training, all of that. And then I'd say around March of 06, I went to, got sent to Baghdad. And the base that we were on, it was the Baghdad International Airport. The base was built up around the airport. And I was there working. I was in a fabrication shop. I was a machinist. So just doing normal duties. And then the call came up that they needed a convoy escort detail to escort the civilian drivers, like Sam on episode 2. And I think I might have had 1 or 2 days training on what we were going to be doing and just thrown into the fire. Some of the stuff that we did on our convoys, you know, we'd escort the civilian trucks from one base to another. And when I went over there, it was, I think the time frame for me was a little bit after when Sam was talking about his initial time over. So things were a little bit different. And, you know, we would escort the, like he was talking about the TCNs, the what they call the third country nationals, you know, the Pakistani, the different countries around there. We would escort those guys as well. And it was a lot better escorting American civilians than those guys. Because when we had those guys on convoys, if we had to stop on the road for any reason, they'd go ahead and they'd climb back into their sleeper and try to grab a nap, whether we were stopped for 5 minutes or if we were stopped for 2 hours. So we'd have to send one of the gun trucks up and go knock on their door and wake them up and tell them, hey, it's time to roll. But yeah, we'd escort those guys. We'd escort the KBR civilian. We escorted other military trucks, different military equipment. But the way we would have our convoy set up is we had a gun truck in the front, and then 4 to 5 civilian trucks, and then a second gun truck, then 4 to 5 civilian trucks, and that's how it was all the way back. And then we would usually, you know, we'd have a gun truck in the back facing the rear. And where I was in the second gun truck. I was the driver for the second gun truck. And while we were driving, it was our job to watch for IEDs, anything that, you know, any obstructions in the road, anything that didn't look right. Because they were getting sneaky with the way they were disguising their bombs. They would build them into the side of the roads using spray foam and camouflaging it to where it just looks like part of the sidewalk. And if you knew what you were looking for, most of the time you could spot it. But there were some good painters out there in Iraq. They took pride in their work, and they did a good job of disguising those. Luckily we never lost anybody in our team. You know, we had taken fire a couple times, but we'd usually roll out at night, and they had a very strict curfew that once, I think it was 8 or 9 o'clock PM, the civilians were, you know, the Iraqi locals were to be in their house, and they didn't come out till about 7 AM, I believe it was. So we had that window where there were no, where there was no civilian traffic. So we had the roads to ourselves, but that didn't make it any less nerve wracking. It was very eerie driving down those highways at night with no traffic. Let's see. Being the second truck in the team, if we did roll up to a convoy, we basically owned that. If we rolled up to an IED, we basically owned that IED, meaning it was our responsibility until the explosive ordnance disposal guys, the EOD, until they were able to come out, inspect it, and either blow it on spot or do what they do with it. So then in order for us to control the situation, one truck would have to drive past the device and out about 100 to 200 yards, depending on what it was, and secure the highway coming the other way in case there was a civilian or another convoy team coming up. We were able to stop them and keep them out of the harm's way. But in doing that, that put my truck within 10 to 15 feet of whatever device it was.
Wow. Yeah, that is crazy.
Yeah, that happened a couple times that I can recall clearly. I know there's a lot of things that happened over there that my mind still blacks out. It doesn't, you know, my brain doesn't let me remember it for probably for good reason.
Most definitely.
But yeah, I did convoys for about 8 months over there, and on one of the convoys, on one of the items that I had emailed to y'all, it was, I would say it's a defining moment in my life. It was a big turning point. It woke me up to seeing things differently. We rolled out to a little base called Rustamaya, and it was a pretty hot zone. And from the start of that, before we even started rolling out that night, I remember on episode 2, Sam was talking about a guy telling him that he had the feeling that something was going to happen, that he was going to die, you know, something like that. I had a similar experience to that. I knew something was going to happen. I knew it was going to be bad. I knew it was going to be more or less catastrophic, very, you know, a lot of damage, but I couldn't tell if it was going to be, you know, somebody die, whatnot. I just knew something bad was going to happen. And, you know, my team, you know, they all saw that something was bothering me, and we all kind of talked about it, talked what was going on. And at that point, we'd all come to the realization that, you know, your gut feeling is there for a reason. You trust your gut. And so we roll out and we get most of the way there. I think we're a mile from Rustamaya. And one of the things that you watch for IEDs is trash pile, you know, trash where it doesn't belong. You know, a trash bag, a tire, you know, just something that's out of place. You know, that last mile coming into Rustamaya, the trash was piled up to 8 feet on both sides of the road. There was, you couldn't see the sidewalk underneath it. It was just that thick. It looked like a landfill that we were driving through. And so that kind of set the mood for the rest of the evening. And so we get into the base, the civilian trucks, they go where they're going to offload. And we all went to the chow hall to go get some food and, you know, refuel for the drive back, you know, get some energy back up. So we're all sitting in our trucks waiting for the civilian drivers to radio us up that they were ready to go. And we heard an explosion. And at that point, you know, you get to where you can kind of judge the distance of where an explosion is hitting. And I'd say it was a good 600-700 yards out. It hit outside the wire. And then a couple of seconds later, another one hit about half the distance. So we started kind of, you know, it got our interest up. We couldn't tell if it was outgoing or incoming, but either way, it was still far enough away where it didn't seem to be an issue. And so we got up on top of our trucks and we were trying to watch the explosions. And one hits on the other side of us. You know, probably about 500-600 yards the other way. You could hear the impact. And then the sirens went off, telling everybody to get to the bunker. So at that point, we know 100% that's incoming. And when they send incoming, they're sending it to the high population areas, you know, the chow halls, the little shops that we had on base, you know, where you get your all your comfort items, you know, your extra clothes, stuff like that, you know. So those are the places that they would aim for. Well, we were maybe 50 yards from the chow hall where we were sitting. And we all get to the bunkers. And the way these bunkers are set up, they hadn't fully finished setting them up. It was, you know, the concrete, looks like a concrete box that they use to build the bridges, like the small bridges.
Yeah.
Okay, so they take those and they put four or five of them together and then they stack sandbags around them. And that's your bunkers. You know, it's good for shrapnel, stuff like that. That's about it. If it takes a direct hit, that's it. It's a casualty collection point at that point. So the bunkers that they had there, it was just the concrete. There was no sandbags. And my team, you know, it's four trucks with three people each. And then we had one spare driver and one spare gunner that would ride with us. So the main bunker that they all went into, it filled up. There was no room for anybody else. And me, one of the spare drivers, and one of the gunners, we ended up in a section of bunker that was off to the side. And looking back on it, I can see why it was off to the side. It had a pretty significant crack running down the top of it. So structurally, it wasn't very sound. Well, from that, I was able to watch the bunker where the rest of my team was. And I'm watching, and it seemed to me like time slowed down. You know, when you're in a situation like that, your brain's firing real fast. You're relying on instinct. You know, you're relying on your training. And I watched the tail from a rocket coming in, and where I'm sitting, it looks like it's coming straight at the bunker that my team is sitting in. Well, it comes down. It goes through the roof of the dining facility, the chow hall. It didn't detonate. It went through the awning for the entrance, and it stuck in the ground. It was from what I was told, it was a Chinese rocket. You know, it's a Chinese surplus rocket that they'd had sitting in. I want to say they'd keep them in the Tigris River. They'd tie them to a string and toss them in and to hide them. So, it was kind of a flip of a coin whether they would actually detonate or not. But the impact from that lifted me off the ground about 2 inches. Once the dust settled, we realized we need to get to a better bunker. So me and the other gunner that were in that bunker that I was in, we went to go see if we could find a more secure area for the rest of the team. Well, we find one, and it's behind a fence. It's behind a chain link fence. So we figure out, you know, we work our way through that fence and get the rest of the team into this other bunker. And that bunker, it was so packed full of people. We couldn't have fit enough. You couldn't fit a piece of paper between the people in that bunker. Wow. And so I think we were in that bunker for a little while. At that point, I had so much adrenaline going, I couldn't tell you if it was 5 seconds or 5 hours before the civilian trucks, they radioed, they said, "Hey, we're ready to go if y'all are." So we all got in our trucks, you know, we buttoned everything up, got everything fired up and ready to roll. And we told them, "Meet us at the gate and we'll get into position on the way out." So we hit the road, and the normal convoy speed, you know, we were supposed to keep it around 30, and I think catch up speed was 45. You know, you want to make it to where everybody stays together. You know, you don't want to lose anybody, because, you know, if you get cut off, that's when you lose people. That's when you get, you know, people get killed.
Yeah.
So the whole way back, I don't think my speedometer went under 50. We were just barreling down the road going back to our base. We made it back. And, you know, once we get back, we get back to our base, to where our barracks were. And we'd have our convoy meeting. You know, we'd kind of wind down. So we have our meeting. We get done. And we had a little, they called it an internet cafe. It was just I think they had 10 computers and some phones that you could use to call home. Well, I figured that's about the best time to call home and talk to mom.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'd say so.
So, at that point, it was Sunday afternoon back here. I call my mom, I get a hold of her, and, she was saying that they got done with church. They'd go to church early. It was about 7:30 when they'd go to church. And she said that, you know, she was telling me who all they ran into. And, there was a lady that worked at our high school. You know, she was real close with my family. And my mom said that, "Hey, you know, we saw Miss Fraga and Mr. Fraga at church." And she said they were praying for you. And I asked her, you know, what time was that? And she told me, and the time from when they saw, you know, when they were at church and when that event happened, those times coincided very closely. So I would say, by the grace of God, that's why I'm still sitting here.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. You got that right. That is really cool.
So these experiences you had over there, I understand that, like, some people get affected by stuff more than others, but how much on a deeply impactful level was these experiences for you? I mean, is this something that you kind of, like, you carry around to this day, and, like, did it cause PTSD or anything like that? Or is it something that you just kind of look back out and you're just like, yeah, that happened?
Well, I was never officially diagnosed with PTSD. When you're in the military, there's a stigma for going to see the shrink. And that's something that I've, you know, went on social media when I'm talking to people. That's one thing that I've been trying to tell. I've still got buddies that are in. I try to talk to people that are in, that if they are having issues, talk to somebody about it, because I never did. And when, let's see, I met my wife, I think, 8 months after I got back from Iraq. And that time, that year after I got back from Iraq, I couldn't be around fireworks of any kind. I couldn't be around anybody that was shooting if I wasn't the one, you know, if I wasn't part of the group that was shooting. Like, if we were out four-wheeling and there were people out there shooting, I'd have to leave. But we were out, I think it was Memorial Day weekend. I was stationed up in Alaska. And we'd go on the weekends, we'd all load up in our pickups and we'd go four-wheeling. well, it's Memorial Day weekend, and there's some people down the creek bed. They start shooting off fireworks, and from the time the first one went off to the time my buddy finally pulled me out from under the pickup truck, I don't remember anything. I completely blacked out, and he said they were looking for me. They couldn't find me. And finally they saw me underneath the pickup truck. I was curled up in a ball underneath the pickup truck. And to this day, I wish I'd have gotten help back then. Cause it's still, you know, there's still times now that it affects me, but I've developed coping mechanisms. I keep an open line of communication with my wife. She knows most of what went on over there. So when I'm having issues, I'm able to talk through it with her, and she helps me get through it.
Now, that's really awesome. I'm glad to hear that. But is it too late to get help? Can you get to a counselor? Is there a way to do that now?
I went through the VA a few years back, and I'm sure they're getting better about it now. At the time, they'd throw pills at the situation. Like they gave me blood pressure pills for nightmares, even though I've always had low blood pressure, you know, not dangerously low, but not low enough where I would need any kind of medication for it. And they would give me blood pressure medication for any nightmares that I was having. They had me on antidepressants, all this other stuff that were causing more issues in my day-to-day life than if I wasn't on them. And that's why, you know, they didn't have any actual really counseling sessions. Anytime I went in, it was, so how's your medication working? How can we adjust it? Bye. And that was it.
Wow.
And I know there are groups out there that are not affiliated with any government organization. You know, they're standalone groups, and there's one around this area that I'm wanting to get in touch with and start talking to them. It's a blacksmith group that they deal with PTSD, and it's a very family type organization. So I'm looking into getting into that, but scheduling wise, it's kind of hard.
Oh yeah, I can imagine it is.
But I was wanting to tell y'all when I'm sure y'all have heard about, you know, when soldiers come back from deployment, you know, they go out and they buy the fastest cars. They buy what they can afford. They buy the fastest cars. They go out and they start doing crazy stuff and they get hurt. Stuff like that. There's a reason for that. When you're on a deployment, as soon as you step foot in country, your adrenaline is about 100 times higher than it's ever been in your life. It doesn't go down until you get back off the plane back stateside. And it's like a drug. You get to the point where you're so used to having that level of adrenaline that when you come back, you don't have it in you. You chase it. You try to find things that get that adrenaline going. And for some of the guys, it ends up, sad to say, they end up dying from it. You know, they're going too fast down the highway and don't see the curve, you know, stuff like that. But that's another issue that people deal with coming back.
Yeah, I can imagine that it can be, you know, a difficult transition. And I've thought about that a lot, you know, when it comes to those who serve in the military and transitioning back into civilization here stateside. It's gotta be difficult because you're being trained and told to be, you know, soldiers and you're in the middle of fighting and people shooting at you, and to be able to transition back to, you know, just normal life again, it seems like it'd be a very hard thing to do.
Oh, it is. Now, Tony, I know you don't, you said you don't watch a lot of TV or movies. So yeah. I'm not sure if you've seen this one, the movie Hurt Locker.
Nope. That doesn't even sound familiar to me.
I've seen it.
Well, it's got Jeremy Renner. He played Hawkeye in the Avengers franchise. A lot of people don't like that movie because it's not realistic. But the part of it that is realistic is at the opening credits of the movie, it talks about how war is a drug, and it's a very addictive drug. The more you go, the more you deploy, the more used to it you get, and you get to the point where you feel more at home on deployments than you do back stateside. I've met a lot of guys that are that way. I only deployed twice. I went to Iraq once and Afghanistan once. And, each time I came back, both times, I could feel that within the first couple months coming back, it gets harder to transition back. You get so used to, you've got your M16 or your M4 on your back all day, every day. And then you come back here and, you wake up reaching for it and it's not there. It's a scary feeling.
Yeah, I can imagine. It's definitely a scary feeling, and the transition and the getting used to those kind of things can't be easy. So you have these experiences over there. Welcome to the world, young 19-year-old. It always astounds me as to how we are socially in this country, where it's okay if an 18-year-old, a 19-year-old goes off and is trained to kill people, but then, mm-hmm. They come stateside and they're not allowed to do certain things like drink alcohol until they're 21. So it's just like, to me, sometimes it doesn't make sense to me. But you make this transition back into, civilian life. And at what point did you actually think about doing the truck driving thing for a career move? Was that something that was just a natural transition for you from the military, or was it something you had to actually think about and pursue?
No, it was something, it was always kind of there in my mind. I got out of the Army in 2010 and I didn't actually go out and get my CDL. I'm going on 2.5 years of actual truck driving. So when I got out, it's a really hard transition going from military to civilian side. And I jumped from job to job, little odd jobs here. We moved, when I first got out, we moved back down here to Texas. And that's when my first son was born. And then, I think we were back about a year and a half. And my father-in-law, he was having really, he was having real bad heart issues. He had had a really bad heart attack. And we didn't know how much longer he was going to have. Well, they lived up in Haines, Alaska. And it's a small town. If you're going to drive there, you have to get there through Canada. There's no roads connecting it to the United States. It's either drive through Canada, take a plane, or hop on the ferry and you're going to come in on boat. So living out there, it's a hard way of life, and being in bad health, it makes things a little bit more difficult. So we packed up all our stuff. We drove up there and we spent, almost a good 2 years up there in Haines. And, her dad ended up passing away. I want to say it was 2013, summer of 2013. And we stayed up through to the next spring, and then we moved back down here. And then again, I worked odd jobs here and there. I was a car salesman for a while. I worked at the the Toyota factory. And then after the Toyota factory, that's when I said, you know what? I need to do something that's a change of pace. I had seen an advertisement for the Roadmaster driving school, called them up and went up there, got my CDL and started driving over the road.
That's really cool. That's a neat way to go about it. You know, I went to school years ago for this, and I mean, it's a long time ago. It's a long, long time ago. But, you know,
yeah.
One of the things that I did want to ask you, or maybe just mention, is that it seems a lot of times that when we, especially when you talk to guys who are in the service or women, I don't mean it one way or the other. There always seems to be there's one line that I hear from everybody. It was a trial by fire. And that really does seem to catch the imagination of people to understand what you guys have gone through, what you've been through, where you've been, and what you've experienced. And what you experienced over there is just amazing. And I mean, I know we haven't said it to you yet, but I just want to say thank you for your service. I know it's a cliche that we all say, but you know, it really is heartfelt. It's really meant, and we really do thank you for what you did, for the things, for putting your life on the line. You know, you signed the dotted line and you put your life on the line for us, and it's appreciated. I was thinking about just some of the things that you're talking about being over there. I mean, you know, like when you were on these convoys, how long did the ride last as far as when you were going from one point to the next, to your next base that you were heading to?
Well, with ours, it was usually a one night turnaround. So we'd drive out, and most of the places that we went to, they weren't any further than 2.5 hours. So we would drive from our base to, cause our base was really big. We had the airport. That's where a lot of the supplies would come in. So we would take the supplies to the smaller bases around us. So we'd drive out, the trucks would unload, they'd reload with mail, you know, whatever's going to be outgoing. And we'd take it back to our base. And most of the, you know, there were a couple times where we ended up staying the night, or well, I guess staying the day at whatever small base we were at. But we really tried not to. You know, we had all our stuff at our base, and we were close enough where as long as everything went right, we were able to turn around and get back to our base, you know, 2-3 hours before curfew ended.
Oh, that's good. I'm glad to hear that. At least that is a good thing. I guess even like now as a truck driver, everybody likes to get home at, you know, when they can. So
oh, yeah,
even in the service, you know, you got your home base, you know, you want to get back to where, you know, to get back to home, regardless of
definitely.
Where it is, you know.
Did y'all, I don't know if y'all saw any of the stuff that I had written about about my over the road experience.
Yeah. And I wanted to ask you about that actually. So, you're now an over the road driver. And that's something that I've never done. And hats off to you with that too, because over the road guys, man, it's a whole different ball game. And
yeah,
I wanted to ask you if you could kind of go into some of these experiences. One of them made me laugh, but you know, I guess why don't you talk to us about what happened in Louisiana?
Let's see. Well, okay. I don't drive over the road anymore. I work for an oil field company now. So I haul oil field equipment. I'm local, so I'm able to be home every night now. But the one that you were talking about, yeah, I was coming into Louisiana and it was maybe about 9 or 10 in the morning. So I've been driving for a little while. And, one thing that, you know, even before I was in the military, I've always had the mindset, if there's somebody that needs help, I'm going to stop and help them. And I see a bunch of cars pulled over. There, you can tell there's something bad wrong from body language. And so I pull over, and I think I pulled over. Where now, once I got stopped, I was maybe 50 yards past them, but I'm coming back, and as I'm coming up to the main car that everybody was gathered around, they pull a small child, maybe 6-7 months old, out of the car. And as I'm walking up, you you can tell the difference between somebody fainting and just no movement, no life. And when I walked up, it was the latter. There was no life. You could just, you see the child went limp and there was nothing there. And, there's nothing that can prepare you to see something like that. I wouldn't wish that on anybody to walk up on that. But about that time, the emergency crews, they'd already been called. They started pulling up. So with as many people were there already, me being there would have been more me being in the way. So, I feel bad about it, but I got back in my truck and I got back on the road. So I don't know what came of that, but that one kind of affected me for a couple of days. It's hard to get over seeing something like that.
Yeah. I can understand that, man. I mean, when I first started driving truck at the company I'm at, I saw a similar situation. It was an accident scene that I had just come up on, and the lady that was driving the car, I don't know what happened, but she wound up flipping it in an intersection. The car was still spinning when I pulled up.
Oh man.
And I jump out of the truck and I run over, and she's in there screaming and she's crawling out of the car. She's saying her baby's in the car, and you hear the baby screaming. And by now there's a lot of people around the car, and we stopped the car from spinning, and I grabbed the handle of the back door, and adrenaline pumping, and I yanked on it and it was locked, and I just pulled the handle right off the door, and I'm like, all right, so that didn't work. And so I started trying to figure out how we could get in, and somebody wound up getting the door open and getting the baby out and stuff. Thankfully the baby survived and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And it was at a heavy intersection during rush hour, which really caught me off guard because I didn't understand how she flipped it, because nobody's moving fast, so I don't know what happened, but the baby seemed to be fine. But the same thing happened to me. Like I got back in my truck and I left. I mean, there were so many people there, my truck's in the way, and I didn't even see it happen, so I felt like, yeah, I was more in the way than anything. It definitely affected me for a day or so. Not in the sense that I was sad or anything, but I was just thinking about a lot of it. I was just like, wow, that was crazy.
Right. On the whole thing with accidents, I just came off of light duty. I drive a winch truck. We use the winch to load the water tanks and mud tanks and stuff like that onto our trucks. And I was on I-10 coming back into San Antonio, and something fell off of a truck a little ways ahead of me in traffic. So everybody slams on their brakes. I catch a lot of hell for it from the guys at work, but I'm a very cautious driver. I leave a lot of distance between me and the people in front of me, and for this reason. So everybody in front of me, they all come to a stop. I stop, and from the time I stopped, I had time to stop. I believe I turned on my hazards as I was stopping. But I came to a stop, looked at the mirror, and saw that the F-250 behind me didn't see me. And he was doing 75 miles an hour when he connected with the back of my truck.
Wow.
And yeah, it was a good jolt. he ended up totaling my winch truck. The rear axle, the mechanics, they said that the rear axle was pushed forward. I think they said somewhere around 4 inches or so. The tires on both axles were touching. The bumper on the back of my truck was pushed up against the back tires. There were pieces from the grill of the truck that hit me up where my airlines connect to my cab. I'm a very big believer in, things happen for a reason. I don't buy into coincidence very much. And if I wasn't sitting there and the guy didn't see me, there's no way he would have seen the two compact cars that were right in front of me. And luckily everybody was, you know, everybody survived. I think the guy banged up his ankle when he hit me. But if I hadn't been there, I have a feeling it would have turned out a lot differently. I think they may have, there may not have been, people may not have been walking away from it at that point.
Yeah, well, I'm surprised that he walked away from it. I mean, nobody died. Meaning, the guy who hit you didn't die. I mean, that's incredible.
Oh, nobody. Yeah. It was, well, and the way he hit me, it couldn't have been any better. It was a perfectly square on. You know, he was perfectly straight on with my truck when he hit. So it was just a complete transfer of energy from his truck to my truck. If my truck had been cocked off to the side at all, I don't think it would have ended the way that it did. But luckily, everything was lined up the way it was when he hit.
Yeah, that's crazy, man. So you see a very sad story with a baby. You have mm-hmm. this guy hit you. But I'm interested in hearing about Wisconsin. Now, you were leaving an Ashley Furniture, and that's all
yes,
I'm
going
to say.
Yeah.
I want to hear what you have to say about this.
Okay, so at the time, I was team driving. I drove at night because the guy that I drove with, his vision wasn't very good at night. I mean, the headlights from other cars would give him headaches. So he's in the back sleeping, and I just dropped a trailer. I can't remember if I was picking up a load or dropping a load off, but I was leaving that Ashley Furniture, and the road that I was on, it was one lane going one way, one lane coming the other way, and then a real heavy embankment coming off of either side. I was in a Freightliner, and you know, being a truck driver, you know about where your eye level is when you're sitting in your seat. So I'm coming up. There's it's pretty late. So there's not very, very much visibility. It's middle of nowhere. So the only lights are my headlights. I see something on two legs come up one embankment, like they're walking up a flight of stairs. It's that easy. They walk up, cross in front of my truck, and let's see, when they crossed in front of my truck, it was maybe 30 feet in front of me, and it walked across the road back down the other embankment just as easily as it went up to the other side, and it was just shy of eye level with me. Whatever it was, I couldn't see. It was a silhouette. I couldn't make out any real detail of what it was, but I knew it was way taller than any person I had ever seen. And one of my best friends growing up, right now, he's just shy of 7 foot tall, and it would have towered over him.
Yeah, I was kind of thinking that's an awfully tall character, whatever it is, quote unquote, you know, air bunny quotes or whatever you want to call them. That's an awfully tall character.
So, I mean, Jim, what are you saying this is? Because I've never heard of such a thing.
Well, if I had to venture a guess, I would say that I would have thought it was a Sasquatch or Bigfoot. But like I said, I couldn't make out any fur. I couldn't make out skin. So I couldn't tell you what, for certain what it was. But as it goes, it went away as quickly as it came in. And it was just a fleeting glimpse of it, and it was gone.
Wow. So you didn't get a whole lot of detail of this. Now, this Sasquatch thing, it's the first time I've ever hearing of it. I don't know what we're talking about here. if anybody's new to the show and new to hearing me talk and stuff, I have another show that deals with these types of encounters. So, but you see this, whatever it is, walk across the road. You didn't get a great look at it, but I guess the main thing that you can kind of really bank on is the absolute size of this thing. Knowing what your eye level is, you're able to gauge how big right. this thing really was.
Yeah, it was massive. I saw it from the side, so I couldn't tell you how wide at the shoulders it was, but from what I could see, it was proportional to its height. You know, if you see a person that's that tall, the gigantism, the disorder where people just grow and grow, they're not proportional. But from what I could see of this, it was proportional to its height. So there was no lankiness to it.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, I know what you're talking about because I actually went to school with a kid in high school who I was like a freshman when he was a senior. But when he was a senior, he was pushing 7 feet tall, but he was very disproportionate. Mm-hmm. And I think he had like, I think it was like 4 surgeries up at that point in his life just to move his heart up because his body was growing so fast that his organs on the inside were not keeping up with moving throughout the body. And so, and you know, it's sad, but a lot of times those people don't live the longest lives. It's totally different than what you're seeing because you're seeing something that when you're saying proportionate, you're saying the girth going along with the height is
right.
Is resembling of what we would call Sasquatch.
Yes. Yeah. That's what I'm saying.
So let me ask you a question about this. Why? Okay. Did the Sasquatch cross the road? Why would a Sasquatch cross in front of your truck and not wait until you pass by? I don't know why these things do this. Like I've heard many stories and just, I don't get it.
Well, where I was, you know, with as close to the Ashley furniture, you know, he may have just needed a new armchair.
That's hilarious.
But no, as far as that goes, I couldn't tell you. I kind of lean towards the whole trying to show dominance type thing. They're just showing you, hey, I'm here and you're not going to keep me from doing my thing. That's what I get from it.
Yeah. I don't know what to make of it, but it's always interesting hearing people tell stories, especially when it crosses a road. And it's just like, it's a very simple thing, but people see these things cross the roads a lot. And I'm just like, why? Why would they cross the road right in front of you?
Well, and especially, you know, especially out there where there's no other traffic. There were no other trucks out there. You know, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. There's no, you know, that Ashley furniture, there's really not much else out there. It's all farmland. There's no, you know, nobody's getting ready to head off to work. So if he'd have waited the 20 seconds it would take me to drive past them, I never would have seen him. I never would have known it was there. it's kind of puzzling why it would cross right in front of you.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I was thinking the exact same thing. I mean, it's 2 o'clock in the morning in the middle of Wisconsin somewhere. I don't think there's a whole lot of traffic hanging around. And I don't know what Wisconsin is known for, but I know it's not known for 8 foot tall people who just happen to walk around, you know. They're not just having to walk around Wisconsin somewhere out in the middle of nowhere. But you know what? And especially when they could, you know, like you said, you know, he could have waited for, you know, 20 seconds for you to drive by and then walk across the road. It does seem to me like there's a reason for this. And you know, until somebody has one, as Mr. Germer says, in their garage and is studying it, we won't really know the reasons for this. But, you know, it is one of those things that you look at and you shake your head and you question. And you're like, well, you know, I don't know. That's the only answer you can do is shrug your shoulders and say, I don't know. You know, but we'll go with that for now.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. All right. So talk to me about this other experience you had. Okay. So we covered a lot of different stories here, different experiences. And we go from, you know, sad stories to Bigfoot crossing the road. So let's wrap it up with this little bit of a comical story here that you experienced one night in your truck.
All right. Well, when I was driving solo, I've got a red heeler. He's a cow dog. He used to ride in the truck with me when I was going solo. And I don't know if you've ever been around red heelers or blue heelers. They've got a personality to them. They're very much like a child. They will argue with you. They'll talk back. And we were sleeping one night. I can't remember what truck stop we were at. It was either a TA or a Petro, you know, one of the bigger ones. And for the lack of a better term, they've got lot lizards. And when I shut down for the night, I don't get out of my sleeper for anything. You know, I don't care if somebody's knocking on my truck, whatever. They can wait till the morning when I'm ready to roll out. Me and Chief, we're bedded down. He's sleeping by my feet. And I hear a real light knock on the window of my truck. I was driving a Kenworth at the time. And Chief heard the knock. And, you know, he's not used to people knocking on the door of my truck. So he gets up real quietly and pokes his head through the curtain. And he looks. Well, it was real humid that night, and we had the AC running, so the windows were all fogged up, and you couldn't see out. And he climbs up on the driver's seat, and he's looking, and he's trying to see who's knocking on the door. And I poked my head through the curtain just in time to see that lot lizard wipe the fog off the outside of that window to look in. And Chief sees her. And she sees him, and when they lock eyes, that's when he goes into attack mode. His teeth are bared, his teeth, you know, he's barking, snarling, his teeth are bouncing off the window. And this girl couldn't have been over 5 foot tall, and she jumps straight back. She was standing on that top step. She jumps straight back and lands on her butt, and I'm laughing, and you know, I calm Chief down. He's wagging his little nub of a tail. I told him, good boy. I told him to, you know, hang tight. I walked into the truck stop, got a cheeseburger, and that's the night Chief earned his cheeseburger.
Oh, my word. That's awesome.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, man. If I was out in the road like you, I definitely would have a dog with me in the truck. Dogs are great security systems. They let you know when something's up that you can't hear and stuff.
Yeah, they. Oh yeah, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it's just dogs are great, and you know, I totally. I'm envious of the truckers with dogs because I don't have a dog myself. I was trying to get my wife to concede to getting a dog, and then all of a sudden she gets pregnant again. I'm like, dang it. There goes the dog idea.
Yeah. Well, I know you're saying that was the last one, with Chief. He's really protective. I've got an 8-year-old and a 6-year-old right now, both boys. Well, my 8-year-old, he had walked, he takes Chief out in the backyard, and the way our yard is set up, we can't really keep them contained, so we take them out on the leash. One of our neighbors, they had a pit bull that was, you know, it's on the bigger side of the pit bulls, real stocky, real big frame. Well, he comes over that fence, and he knocks down my 8-year-old. His name's Slade. He knocks down Slade. Well, Chief jumps in there and starts tangling with that pit bull. Chief, on a good day, weighs 40 pounds. And he held that dog. he grabbed a hold of it and he would not let go until I got there and I had the situation handled. But as soon as I grabbed a hold of that dog, he let go and sat down and looked at me like, "Hey, did I do a good job?"
Where's my cheeseburger?
yep. So, he had a couple of nicks from that one, but you couldn't ask for a better dog. He's super protective, super, great dog. And I'm glad we have him around. So,
yeah, and I think that's always a great thing is when you have a dog that actually, does what we want dogs to do, put themselves down for the kids, and things like that.
Definitely. Definitely.
You said it was a pit bull. What's interesting is the stigma that pit bulls have, because the term that we have for somebody that's a babysitter, we call them a nanny. That term comes mm-hmm. from pit bulls, because back in the day, pit bulls were farm dogs, pretty much, where they watched the kids while people went out
right.
on the farms, and they called them nanny dogs. And so it's mm-hmm. it's just interesting that your dog had to do what pit bulls were originally supposed to be doing, because this pit bull was stepping right. out of line. So
yeah, well, and I don't buy into the whole bad breed type thing. I know a lot of people have had pit bulls that they were. They wouldn't hurt a fly. They're the sweetest, most friendly dogs. They'd walk into traffic if they thought it'd make you happy. Where the problem comes in is the way people raise them up, and that's a shame.
Yeah, it's they take the best part about these dogs, which is their loyalty. They truly will mm-hmm. do anything you tell them to do, and they take their loyalty and they manipulate it into making them into violent fighting dogs because they're super strong. And it is a shame. It's a big time shame. But Jim, man, I appreciate you sharing these stories, dude. It's been fun.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It was good talking to you. It's an honor to be on here.
The honor was all ours. It really was. We really enjoyed having you. It was a good conversation. I enjoyed the stuff happening in Iraq, and I definitely love the truck driving stuff over here. It's always interesting to hear what other people experience.
Yes, sir.
Well, that's the show, everybody. We really hope you enjoyed it. And if you did enjoy it, please share the show with your friends, because that's the best thing you can do to help the show grow. Share it with your friends. And we don't care where you share it. Just share the show with your friends if you enjoyed it. And until next week, drivers, keep the hammer down in the hammer lane.